like in the movie Pay It Forward, everyone is sort of being a beacon of light as they get better and improve, and that goes on. And I think it's the same thing here, where you've seen someone whose life was in some ways the darkest you could think about in terms of the kind of things that he was hoarding and preaching, and now it's completely turned around. So instead of being a tornado of chaos, it's really a beacon of light.
Welcome to Spiritually Hungry. We are very excited today to have a special guest and friend, Matthew Stevenson. And I want to ask our listeners, would you invite a white supremacist to your family dinner or a dinner party at your house? Think about that long and hard. Probably not for most. Yet that is what I don't want to label you, but I would say Kabbalah student, among many other things, Matthew did. And it had a profound effect on his guest, who was the heir to the white nationalist movement and godson of David Duke, which makes this story even more interesting. So we're very excited to introduce Matthew and hear a firsthand account of how the power of a simple act of kindness can make a profound difference. And we've had the opportunity to sit with you before and discuss this, and now we've invited you on our podcast to do it again. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's dig right in. Tell us how you met his Derek Black.
Yes.
And what your first impression was, and what really gave you the impetus to reach out to him and invite him, not just to a dinner party, but it was a Shabbat dinner, right?
Yes. So we started at the same year at the same college, New College of Florida, which was a very small school, very liberal arts school in Sarasota, Florida. At the time, had about 800 students total across 4 years. So you can imagine about 200 people a year. So frankly, everybody knew everybody. And he lived in a dorm just downstairs from my dorm. And it was a dormitory that everything faced outside. So essentially, when I opened my front door, I could see his front door. And there were little communal tables down there. And sometimes he'd sit around playing his guitar, old country and Western songs. And I like those kind of songs. And so I would sometimes go along. And as everyone who's heard me sing can attest, really ruin the whole experience for everybody by joining in. And so we got to know each other a little bit that way. We also were in a class together, which we had shared some notes for. And
because it's a small school, I'm sure the rumor mill was kind of, you know, everybody knew who his godfather was.
No, well, because he was, no, not at all at first, because at first he was not incognito in the sense of using an alias or anything like that. He was using his real name, but he was totally mute about his affiliations with the white nationalist movement and his family's affiliations with the Klan and white nationalism and so forth. And it really isn't a thing that most people think to do, to Google whether a person is or is not involved with the Klan. And so I didn't think to do it. But someone at the school, and so actually I knew him for probably something on the order of 6 months.
Were you saying you were your friends?
We were friendly. Once I'd watched a movie with a group of people in his room. We had, like I said, exchanged notes in a class once. We'd sung. So I knew him. I knew his name. I think I definitely had his phone number in my phone, right. But we were not close friends or anything like that, obviously, because, you know, I didn't know very much about it.
Do you know if he knew that you're Jewish at the time?
Yes, because I wore a kippah, which is a little skull cap that some Jewish men wear.
Like you have on, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the fact that I was visibly Jewish did not elicit any kind of a reaction from him. It wasn't like he said some sort of slur when he noticed it. Not at all. I had no indication whatsoever from his behavior towards me or towards anybody else, frankly, around me, that he held those views. Only some months later, when someone was researching white nationalism, not him, but white nationalism writ large, that they came across a picture of him. And he had, at the time, long red hair. And that kind of stands out anywhere. And at this college, it was very obvious that there was like one guy who fit that description. It was this guy. And
isn't that funny how that happens, right? Like, oh, you know, just by chance, but everything, it's fate. Like
it's hard to understand exactly how, you know, you would think it's almost contrived if it were in a movie. Right. But that's the reality. And he was at the time studying abroad in Germany. And of course. Yes. And you're not the first to make that joke. And so he wasn't even on the campus to respond. And of course, it was like the whole campus, like you said, was like to say a rumor mill was an understatement. I mean, at this point, this was the only thing anyone wanted to discuss for probably the next couple of years. Yeah, it was very shocking and bizarre. And they canceled. I mean, they had big protests. And they canceled classes for a day in part to protest his presence.
Even though he wasn't on campus. Just
I can't remember if that was after he had returned to the campus in the fall or not, but he was certainly going to be returning. I don't remember the exact, but point being is that it went from no one knowing to everybody knowing pretty much in the blink of an eye.
And what did you think when you found out?
Well, of course, it was the craziest thing I'd ever heard. I had heard of the website that his father had founded, Stormfront, which is the first and I'm not sure if still, but at one time the largest white nationalist hate website around. And so it was kind of bizarre that this person who I had known in this somewhat innocuous context actually had these rather nefarious affiliations. And not only was it something that his family was involved with, his father or his mother's former husband, as well as his godfather, is a man named David Duke, had been for a long time the leader of the Klan. After David Duke left the Klan, Derek's father had taken over and been running the Klan.
Oh, he was the head of, I didn't know that. His father became the head of the KKK?
Yeah, and then they had left. I think it was, I don't remember exactly, somehow too liberal for them. So this was the kind of thing you're dealing with. And he himself, Derek, was being groomed from, I'm sure, a fairly young age to be kind of the heir apparent. Now, it's not to say that his parents pushed it on him, which they didn't, but it's the milieu that things are around. And that's kind of the, you know, all of your father's family's friends are in that world and they're going to rallies and talks and things like that. And that was the world that he grew up in. And by the time that I got to meet him, he was running conferences and things like that for travelers.
Yes. He was all in.
Yes.
Interesting. So then he comes back. What's your first interaction after you find out what his beliefs are, where he's from?
Action also, like he must have felt, I mean, maybe not. One would likely feel frightened or feel alone, but maybe not when you have a group like that behind you. I don't really know. So when he came back, he must have been surprised that he was.
I think that his goal had been, at least at first, to remain anonymous. But I do think that living a double life was very taxing and much more taxing than he had originally anticipated, because when you're doing things like, on the one hand, dating a Jewish girl, and then you're going and having a radio show in the morning, which he obviously doesn't know about, where you're decrying the Zog and whatnot, it's not an easy thing to compartmentalize.
So already
he was starting to feel like he should be more open about his background and his beliefs. And in some ways, I think it was a relief for him when he was outed. Not that it was a great experience for him, but it was at least this fear of what could be and this constant monkey on his back and looking over his shoulder was out.
So he was already dating a Jewish girl.
He was dating a Jewish girl. He had dated a Jewish girl. I think that they had maybe broken up while he went on to study abroad or, you know, taking some time apart. But she had not known about his
beliefs
and activities. And needless to say, she found out at the same time I did. So she wasn't thrilled about that.
Wow.
So what was your first?
So when he came back, first thing, I had a couple friends who were supposed to be rooming with him in the dorm. Almost everybody in the college lived in the dormitories all 4 years. And I had heard from one of them that he had suddenly dropped out of the rooming thing. So I texted them asking, making sure that he had where to stay and that he wasn't going to be essentially homeless because of this, to make sure he could stay on my couch if he needed to.
So your internal feeling toward him was?
Well, it was, I mean, of course, on the one hand, there is a revulsion at the kind of things that his ideology espouses, not just because it targets me, but because in general, it is an approach that is as diametrically opposed to human dignity and love for other people as possible, right? When you're talking about almost by definition, an organization based around hatred, right? But at the same time, I recognized that he was a human being, not some sort of monster. And he had been in an environment his whole life up until I had met him, where he had been living at home in this environment, surrounded by things, just in the same way that I was, I'm sure, influenced tremendously by my own parents in my upbringing. I'm sure anyone would be under similar circumstances. So to what extent did he come freely to those decisions, and can I really judge him as a result?
But I want to pause here for a second, because I think that this is what I find truly inspiring about you. Not just the story, but a lot of people would like to think that they would do the right thing in a situation like that. But then what steps in is, you know, oh, you know, he's against my people, or he's a bad, like, they can't even see past that, you know, very often. And so, and I guess maybe this is your parents' influence on you, but were you ever, I mean, I just think that's a really powerful, that's not the norm.
Yeah, what I'm thinking is also,
even people
they'd like to do the right thing. Some people, I would say maybe the majority of people would say the right thing would be to hate him. Right, to meet hate with hate and ostracize him. I mean, right,
and he should know how it feels to be the one. Yeah, or he doesn't deserve.
He doesn't deserve kindness, or which I think, you know, and obviously we'll get further into the story. But I think for Monica and myself, I know this is the most amongst the more both teachable moments, but inspiring elements of this story is the fact that your spirituality brought you to that decision, which is, yes, of course, I completely disagree with all of his all of his basic beliefs and hatred. But my but your reaction to that was not, I'm going to meet hate with hate, but rather still love and still human dignity. And as we look at our world today, right, the solution to hatred is never hatred. And it's not certain, and it's also not agreeing, right? So people think, oh, either you agree with somebody or you hate them for their terrible beliefs. No, what about a third way, which is, no, I can completely disagree with everything that they stand for, but as a human being, I still show human dignity and love.
Yeah, I think where people get tripped up, though, is they want to do the right thing. And the right thing isn't necessarily, it's usually not the kind thing or the compassionate thing. Our new children's book, Tale of the Other Glove, is that's the exact premise of it. Would you rather be right or kind? And I'm just, again, I mean, I don't want to, like, it'll build you up, but I'm saying I'm really impressed with it. That was your, sounds like immediate reaction.
Yeah, I mean, I felt so at the time, just by way of background, I had been hosting these Shabbat dinners, Friday night dinners on the campus since I had gotten there. There wasn't really any Jewish life per se when I got there. And I was back in Miami sometimes, but when I was in the campus, I was hosting these dinners and I built them up reasonably well over the year before he returned to the campus. And when he returned to the campus, I was speaking with a friend of mine, Moshe Ash, who was doing it with me. And we agreed he had been in this environment his whole life of hatred and white nationalism and so on. How many people of Jewish backgrounds or Black people or other kinds of groups that ideology is sort of diametrically opposed to, had he actually really interacted with on a personal way? Probably very few growing up. I imagine didn't have a lot of the house guests. So this was maybe a unique opportunity, because after graduating, he'd be back in that world, back in that orbit, in the probably kind of an echo chamber of an orbit, and he would never interact in a personal way with a Jew ever again. Mm-hmm. And so if I didn't at that moment invite him and come and try to become close with him in a certain way, that would be maybe a chance that would be totally passed over. And if he doesn't know better, then how can I judge him? At the very least, if he sees a person personal and then he makes his own opinion, fine, he can make his own decisions. But it felt like it was only fair to him to at least give him a chance to see what was beyond that orbit.
Absolutely. It's interesting. It's something I think we've spoken about in a previous podcast, but this idea is that, you know, how foolish it is to judge somebody else, because, like you said, we believe what we believe based on where we grew up, the people we grew, you know, our friends, family. And I often think, and, you know, especially we look at, you know, what happens between Israel and Palestine, between Israelis and Palestinians, is that, you know, amongst the bigger problems is that each side says, you know, my beliefs, my upbringing has brought me to the truth. And those opposed to me are either bad people or false beliefs. The reality is, had I been born there, I'd be believing almost exactly what they're believing. Had they been born where I was born, they'd believe.
Sure.
And which makes, hopefully, awakens more compassion and an openness than most people allow for.
Absolutely. And it's not as though I was blind to the realities of anti-Semitism. I remember being beaten up in Europe when I was 12 or 13 by people, and, you know, because I was wearing a kippah and they're spitting on me and things like that. And I want to say I was used to it, but it was not something that was surprising or shocking or alien to me in a certain sense. And so it wasn't that I thought that this was just idle rhetoric. I saw, in a practical sense, the kind of things at that time even. And of course, unfortunately, since then, with things like social media, a lot of things that actually Derek was promoting, things like the idea of a white genocide taking place, things like that, became very salient in the minds of a lot of white nationalists who unfortunately have gone on in some cases to do some very horrible things in terms of killing people and so on.
And I think also it's such another powerful idea is that you thought on some level that, look, I have an opportunity here right now, and maybe I can affect change in this person's life where he'll have a different perspective or maybe even different beliefs. And I think far too often, many of us stop short and think, oh, what difference? I mean, we talk about this a lot. What difference can I make? You know, really, am I going to have that amount of influence over this person? Why should I even bother or try? So another powerful idea, I think, to be inspired. You know, you never know what kind of difference you can make in somebody's life. And we don't even really know what they're thinking. Who knows what Derek was really feeling inside of me. If he was dating a Jewish woman, I would imagine
he's
not that conflicted.
I don't know. No, it's true. And it also wasn't something that, so I would say, first of all, I coming from my position, had maybe a certain way of influencing that is different than how other people might have been able to influence. I think it was valuable that the people went and said, you know, very vocally how unacceptable these views were and how much chaos they were causing. Not just directly people that he was, you know, he never hurt anybody or anything like that.
He had not.
No, it's, you know, he's
just
not,
words,
direct,
just
not directly, but right. You might say, well, there's a rhetoric. Domino effect. And if you start the dominoes and it ends with some chaos somewhere, you know, you're not totally absolved. And at the same time, I knew that if I came and said to him, you know, you're horrible, you're wrong, etc. First of all, I obviously have something of a horse in the race, so I don't think that I'm totally unbiased, and he wouldn't see me as unbiased. And he's heard from people his whole life telling him that he's horrible, getting death threats. What am I going to tell him? He hasn't heard before. But maybe he hasn't had this before. And maybe he won't have an opportunity. Maybe somebody, I don't know, maybe somebody else would have had the opportunity to be in that position to do that with him, but maybe not. And I didn't want to take that chance.
Beautiful. So you text him.
So I texted him, and first thing I had done is asked to make sure he had a place to stay. And he said it's fine. He had found a place off campus.
For and you're not reasons. Talking about the controversy. In fact, we never talked.
We invited him to dinner for Shabbat dinner, and he came that week. He came, in fact, the next week. And he came any week he was able to for the next 2 years. And that two-year period, we spent a lot of time together and became in many ways very close. And we never once discussed his ideology or
that's
race
crazy.
Or his beliefs at all.
Weren't you tempted?
Sure. Of course I was tempted. Yeah, of course.
And not just you. I say the other people.
He's such a good
table.
Kabbalah student. Look what restriction he's been practicing.
I told people too. Before he came that it wasn't an ambush and that if we started to go into him, he's going to throw on his defenses. His armor goes on. And first of all, he's been in this position dozens, maybe hundreds of times in his life. He's not unused to being accosted. So he'll go away and he'll never come back. And what will we have accomplished? Maybe inconvenience him for the evening. And that's it. So what do we do? So, in fact, a lot of people stopped coming to the dinner because they didn't want to be around him. They didn't want they sort of felt like it would be giving like a safe space to a Nazi, something like that. I felt like it was important to build a human connection and not to try to prove I'm right and he's wrong. Obviously, I think I'm right and he's wrong. That's by definition. I always think I'm right. But I didn't think that trying to prove it in the moment and trying to even ask questions and try to like settle my curiosities, which were, as you might imagine, significant. Like I didn't want to do anything that could derail this process. So for 2 years, I really had no idea in a direct sense where he was, whether he was getting more involved in white nationalism, which he was for the beginning of that period, or whether he was leaving it behind until he came out very publicly with a letter posted online where he renounced it. That was the first that I heard of it. So Just like when I heard about that he was a white nationalist, I heard at the same time as everybody else. When I heard he was no longer a white nationalist, that was also at the same time.
So tell us about that. That's really a bold move.
But before that, so the you said there were people who stopped coming to the Friday night dinner.
Yes.
Because he was there.
Yes.
And what were those conversations? Did they have conversations with you? What were those conversations like?
That if he would be there, that they wouldn't come. So I told them that they were always welcome, but that he was going to be there. So they were welcome to come whenever they want.
Very impressive.
And again, I think, did it ever get contentious or was just...
No. I mean, it's my house. They can come. If they want my food, they don't have to play by my rules.
But again, I think to the point we were speaking about earlier, I think that's, again, a very... especially in today's world, right?
Yeah.
That concept of for 2 years, right?
Yeah.
To be inviting into your home somebody who you deeply disagree with, but showing that human dignity, right? I think that's, you know, I think we're...
Well, deeply disagree with, but also finding places of and points of connection.
Yes. Yeah. I wonder what were those conversations? I mean, I guess it was about everything else but white nationalism.
Yeah. I mean, we found a lot of common ground. I already mentioned that we had a common interest in music. We have common interests in history and sort of the history of religions, all sorts of things that were...
I mean, that conversation didn't even lead you to the white elephant in the room?
Yeah, it was interesting. One time, it got close, got close once. We were talking about early Christian heresies, and he mentioned a book he liked a lot. And
yeah, it was written by...
One of the early Christian heresies is called Arianism, named after Bishop Arius. So I said to him, without thinking, I guess you wish the Arians had won. But of course, everyone at the table thinks... a different way of spelling Arians, right? So that was as close as we can. And of course, he's like, everyone starts laughing, right? Because it's sort of the elephant in the room for, at this point, you know, a year and a half or something. So absolutely, there was an element of that. I would say that the story that really stuck with me since I was like very young, I remember Shimon Sarfati, who had been a teacher in the Kabbalah Center in Miami, had, when I was growing up, had always said, which was this idea of a rock that... there was, you know, to paraphrase slightly, that there's a rock in the entrance of a palace and the prince is told by God that he should push the rock. And of course, at first, the prince is very enthused and he keeps pushing and pushing and eventually he finds himself in the same position he started in. The rock's not moved at all and he's tired and sweaty and everything. And the next day, he's a little less enthused and the next day, a little less. And eventually, he starts his day by putting his finger on the rock and then he goes about whatever day he wanted to have. And when he leaves the world, the creator says to him that you failed. You didn't do what I said to push the rock. And I said, I pushed and pushed and pushed. And the rock was still there. It didn't budge. He said, yeah, but I didn't tell you to move the rock. I moved the rock. So I felt like it was not my responsibility to worry too much about the outcomes and the ends of the process, that if I just worried about the process itself and making sure that what I was doing was with what I felt was a good consciousness and hopefully with, you know, some positive indications would sort of sort itself out by itself at the end.
Interesting. So this is 2 years, you're inviting him home to your home and not talking about his beliefs. And then?
Yes. And then he one day, basically around the time that he had was graduating, which was a year before I had graduated because he transferred in, he posted a letter online in which he said, again, I'm paraphrasing, but that he no longer believed in white nationalism. And not only did he no longer believe in white nationalism, but that he felt that it was a evil and corrosive force. And needless to say, that did not go over super well with the white nationalists. His father called him and said that you've been hacked. He assumed that his son's email had been hacked into and that was the gestation of this letter. And then Derek told him that, no, it wasn't hacked. It was, it's real. His father said, I wish you were never born. And
wow. Well, what was Derek's plan, though? So he's graduating. And did he, if that was the plan to follow in those footsteps before? So where was he going to live? He didn't have family now.
In terms of the graduating? Well, he was going to graduate school. He was about to go to graduate school. So he had been accepted into a graduate school. And so as far as.
And he could support himself like he didn't.
Yeah, the graduate programs were, they give a small stipend for the students. You know, you're not living high on the hog, so to speak. But yeah, you live.
So then I'm assuming in retrospect, you did speak to him about that 2 year process.
Yes.
And what was that? What did he share with you?
I think that it was as much of a white elephant for him as it was for me. Right. And so it was interesting after all of the time, finally having some of the curiosity sated. Although in many ways, by the end,
it didn't matter.
It didn't really care. Yeah. You know, it was interesting in the same way that telling someone a story about the past might be interesting, but it was by that time, you know, sort of a moot point. The understanding of what drove him to abandon those views was interesting, because I think it was really a confluence of things. Like I said, of course, I developed a very close relationship with him through these Shabbat dinners, and outside of these Shabbat dinners, he wasn't exactly getting invited to a lot of things on the campus. So he was spent a lot of time at my place, and he definitely had a personal connection, sort of an ethos connection that he wouldn't have had otherwise with people with whom white nationalism has issue. But it wasn't as though that was something that happened in a vacuum. There was also someone who spent a tremendous amount of time with him going through asking why you believe, you know, this is not at the table. Like I said, I didn't discuss this directly with him, but she came from a white Catholic background and was fairly innocuous for all of white nationalism concerns. And the reasons that he kept giving her, she actually spent the time and went going through and saying, well, actually, you know, this is wrong for this reason. You know, this study is, you know, this is, and of course, people can point to things, but eventually, if you believe 1% of what white nationalism believes, you're no longer a white nationalist. Mm. So gradually, one leg of the table was whittled away and another leg of the table was whittled away. And eventually, he's left essentially without that belief system, almost inadvertently. And then lastly, like I said, there were many people on the campus who were very vociferous in their, and very vocal in their voicing opposition to white nationalism and making sure that people who were opposed by white nationalism would feel safe and secure. And I think that also influenced them, because they weren't random people. There were people he respected, people he'd known during that first year on the campus. And so having people who he really respected suddenly say that he was out of line was a much different thing than having strangers sending angry emails and threats.
Mm. Interesting. And so that decision,
it seems like his influence changed who influenced him, and therefore that opening was created, right?
Right. And did he, so for him, it was a gradual process. It wasn't one, was there a straw? Do you know of a straw that
I don't think there was one straw. I think it was, like I said, I think you said it was a gradual process, much like a person suddenly,
yeah.
You know, when did somebody start believing X, Y, and Z? Probably most people, they can't really say exactly why or when, but gradually realized he didn't really believe this stuff anymore. And why is he going to spend his life advocating for something that he thinks not only is not right, but is actually hurting people that he loves and cares for?
Now, did this become an international story?
Yeah.
So how did that look like for him, and what was the backlash he received?
So I think that, first of all, when the story broke originally, so first of all, after this public letter in which he renounced white nationalism, his initial plan was to more or less slink away into obscurity after having spent so much of his life in a more public setting and clearly not having been thrilled with how that turned out. But when he started seeing more, whether it was the Charlottesville thing and some other things that had happened that were more prominent in the news around maybe a rising tide of white nationalism, he decided to become more actively involved and more vocal. And he had been sort of hounded by journalists in the months and probably years after that letter. And he told them, I really don't want to talk to you. But that over time changed. And there was a reporter from the Washington Post, Eli Saslow, who was somehow still in touch with him. And they had somehow reignited that connection. And Eli ended up writing a story for the Washington Post, which was the cover story and may have been the most read story in the Post that year online, about what had happened. And eventually that was turned into a book by Eli. And
what's the name of the book?
That book is named Rising Out of Hatred. More recently, Derek has written a book himself named The Klansman's Son. So those are my two book plugs, neither of which I wrote. But the response in the white nationalist world obviously was very negative. And the response within his family was also very negative. His family essentially is their political ideology in the way that some families might be their religious ideology. And the notion that someone could say, well, I'm not, you know, not only not supporting your ideology, but I'm actually going to sort of spend my energies opposing it, but I'd like to come home for Thanksgiving. That's a little challenging. At first, the relationships, I think, were very tense. Now, I think they're still very tense, but somewhat better maybe than they were with the family. He visited the family, his family in December.
It's wild.
But it's not a great situation.
And did you ever meet any of his family?
Yes, I met.
Really?
Yes, I met his mother and his sisters. His sisters are David Duke's daughters. I met one of them. They were very cordial to me, but afterwards apparently had some very negative things to say about him having left them with me. You know, for
they blamed you?
No, they didn't blame me. They blamed him. They came to watch him give a talk about some topic. This was before he had renounced.
They didn't want to talk to you.
Not only didn't want to talk to me is that he had been given a presentation. I came up to congratulate him. Someone came and sort of called him away to talk to someone. And so suddenly I'm in this big hall. There's people all around, but I'm in a certain sense alone with the two of them. And they were not thrilled with that.
Yeah.
I don't know what I was going to do to them, but, you know, that was the case. Yeah, so I did meet them, but I don't think that they're inviting me to Thanksgiving either. So
there's still a rift between him and his family?
Yes.
Interesting.
I don't think that it's possible for that to be completely. I mean, it's so someone is...
You believe in different things.
And the family is as staunchly believing as they were before.
Yes. Yeah. As far as I can tell, as staunch as ever.
And then, so he went on to really make it a part of his life mission, right? To really educate and speak out.
Absolutely. I think that there's a very strong feeling of responsibility that having in earlier years done things that have maybe had ripple effects that even if unanticipated at the time have created so much chaos in the world that he has something of an obligation to correct the harm that he has done.
Interesting.
But I do think that so things like going around and speaking to different organizations. He just wrote, a book, done a lot of other work with different groups, for example, trying to counteract some of the echo chamber nature of social media. He was at Facebook for a little while working on something there. So some rather varied things. But yeah, he's sort of devoted his life in many ways to doing this kind of work.
And I'm assuming, again, he faced backlash from... not just his family, right? But the movement.
Yes. It's interesting because when he first saw this article published, his anticipation was that he would get a lot of backlash, not from the Klan, who obviously had its own already knew and was not happy with him anyway, but from the general public who would think that he is some sort of hidden Nazi or something. Maybe he's just, you know, he's a third column or something. Yeah. So he was, I think, very shocked by how many people were incredibly supportive and inspired by his story, because I think it was very surprising to him and very unlike what he had received from a lot of the earlier press, which was obviously when he was still involved in white nationalism. So you can imagine it was somewhat different within the white nationalist world. Of course, there, you know, he's, I'm sure,
not welcome.
I mean, not only just not welcome, but I think that there's, you know, threats and things of that.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. They're not, you know, usually the peace-loving hippie types don't gravitate towards the Klan. Yeah. So,
Have you found yourself in situations after that time where you were put in a position where it was, you know, what's the right thing to do or the unpopular thing, let's say?
Sure. I think there's a lot of times where people have groupthink. There's this beautiful experiment where they show three lines to people. And one of the three lines are very obviously different lengths. And it's no question which one is longer than the others. And they ask the people which one is the longest. But the first few people to respond to the secrecy of the other participants are actually plants. So they all say it's actually C, you know, it's the middle one is actually the longest one. And it turns out if everyone before you has said that, you're very likely to say that as well, even though it's obvious to your own eyes that it is wrong because everyone before you has sort of confirmed socially that that's the right answer. But if one person breaks that, if one person says otherwise, the reality, what's the longest, then that power, that hold of that group psychology breaks down completely. And so I think that it is, I think very easy to anytime someone is in a environment or a discussion or a world where people tend to jump on these bandwagons of hate and anger and self-pity and other quote unquote reactive emotions. I think that being a proactive voice really can be much more amplified than you'd think. It's not just the one out of the 20 that you might think it is, because actually it changes the way that all 20 people think about the situation.
That's a very important point.
Yeah, and I think that's why we need to talk about it. I mean, it reminds me of, there was a study they did similar to that, where the room, people were like sitting down in a cafe, there were plants in the room also, and the room was full of smoke. And they were told to just sit calmly and pretend like it wasn't there. And some people obviously noticed it, the ones that were not plants, and they just waited until somebody else stood up, yeah. right? Because they didn't want to seem stupid or didn't want to make a mistake. And it's a story as old as time. I mean, remember my favorite children's book when I was little was The Emperor Has New Clothes. And I used to say
No clothes.
Well, no, it's actually, it is new clothes, but I would always say no clothes because clearly it had no clothes.
No clothes?
I think it's new clothes because I wrote about
Emperor,
that.
The Emperor's new clothes.
Yeah. But they're invisible.
But so they're invisible, yeah, that's exactly.
Right. Now it's all coming back to
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah. And the only truth tellers at the end were the children. They're like laughing and saying, why, you know, but everybody, the people that worked for him, the, you know, the staff in the house, the friends, nobody wanted to say that he had no clothes on. Right. And then more than that, they'd say, oh, I love the purple thing. And then the next day somebody's like, oh, this red thing. And he's like, oh, why does it sound different? But no, even himself, right. He didn't want to see truth. So I think we start to look at the world today, like we look at those few that stood out in a big way, like Malala Yousafzai or like just different notable people. But the truth is, and that's why I'm really inspired by you, to your point, if we each just go against the grain, and I've never been interested in groupthink. It's not who we are. But there have been times where we've had conversations like, are we crazy or is everybody else crazy? Because you have so many people going towards wherever the energy is or the safest point. But that's really why we wanted you to come and share the story.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's such an important point, right? Because what stops people, for even people, good people who want to do the right thing, is the idea that, you know, how much impact can I have, right?
Yeah.
And
do you, and also there's fear too. We don't often people don't do the right thing because they're afraid that they'll be ostracized also, that they'll be rejected.
Also, but I think a lot of it also is, you know, how much impact can I have? And to your point, that your impact is actually going to be greater than you think.
Sure.
Because your voice is not just going to influence necessarily the one person or the one situation you're speaking to, but it starts breaking the group thinking, which can have a ripple effect on thousands, millions. I mean, I was thinking about this, you know, it's always interesting, you know, to look at the other way history could have gone. Had you not, you know, been inviting and behaving with human dignity, he very likely would have continued in his family's footsteps.
And not had exposure to all the things you exposed him to.
And then throughout the rest of his life, you know, through the work that he would have done would have negatively influenced thousands upon thousands of people. You know, so it's the idea that this one continuous action changed the lives of people you don't even know, right? Thousands of people who would have been otherwise influenced by him in a negative way. So I think, again, for what I hope for our listeners from this story is to really be inspired to take action. Take action. And the action, to your point, is not argument.
Or teaching. Or explaining, it's just actually showing up and being kind and showing another way.
Yeah. And I wonder in the years, I know you've also spoken about this publicly, in the years since, have you heard back from somebody else or sort of that?
Well, what about those people that wouldn't come over anymore?
You know, it's one of these things where the person who would have shot up a school or something doesn't write you an email, right? I did receive once a very meaningful letter from a lady who's lives, I believe it's in New Mexico, and her father and her son once were going to exercise at the JCC in New Mexico there, and someone with a neo-Nazi background came and shot, unfortunately, both of them, killing both of them.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, she said that if someone had intervened with him, maybe they would still be alive. And so that was very meaningful to me. And so I think it's also easy to think that maybe we're only responsible for the things that we are the proximate causes of, right? And so, of course, I didn't cause any of these things. If he'd gone on, let's say, like you said in your hypothetical, and continued to promote these ideologies and to inspire these actors, in some way I would be responsible also. I had an opportunity and I let it pass me by. And so I, in some ways, am also responsible for being a part of that chain of dominoes.
That's a beautiful idea, I think, right? Because we also often think, like you said, I'm responsible for what I do. But I think, again, a very inspiring idea is we are actually responsible for what we choose not to do.
Yeah.
And the reality is in life, I think for many people, the effects of what they don't do are often greater than the effects of what they do do.
Sure.
And I think, you know, if enough people, good people, right, would actually take that tack, take that path in life, you know, I don't know if it's going to make a difference, but I really don't really have a choice but to try to do, call it the right thing, behave with human dignity, behave with love towards somebody who maybe doesn't deserve it. And you'll never know the negative effect that you have stopped, but maybe more importantly, to really take an acknowledgement of the fact that if there was something that I should have done that I didn't do, I'm actually as culpable for the negative effects as I am for when I directly had a negative influence.
Reminds me of our oldest son, David, many years ago. He was starting to kind of come into his own and have more awareness of his actions. And he said to me, life's too short not to do the right thing. Like, he didn't say life's too short to do the wrong thing, but he changed it. And I thought it was so much more powerful, exactly to the point of what we're talking about. And that could be everybody's mantra, I think, in listening to this episode and hopefully being inspired to do that. Life is too short not to do the right thing.
Yeah. And are there other inspirations, thoughts, ideas that you yourself learned from this story that have stayed with you?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I had experienced very early on, my mother was an alcoholic and had gotten sober when I was fairly young. And I used to go with her to AA meetings. They have
what age? Can you do that?
Yes. They have two kinds of meetings. There's what they call a closed meeting, which is only for alcoholics. Then they have open meetings, which is open to anyone who wants to come.
How old were you?
7, 8, something like that.
It wasn't too young?
I mean, there was no, like, you know, no. I was the youngest one there. I mean, you know, but by some decades, but it was interesting. I met a lot of people in very difficult situations, people who were
struggling, I'm sure.
Struggling and people who had done, I knew a guy who I came to know him quite well, who while drunk and high had run over his son in his driveway, killing him.
I knew
people who had doing all sorts of, you know, and these kind of things, like you said, that you can't imagine. How could somebody possibly come back? I mean, I just want to crawl in a hole. I mean, how could you imagine? And the person that is sponsoring other people, which is helping them to get sober and to help turn their lives around. And of course, in turn, those people are going to do the same thing. Like in the movie Pay It Forward, everyone is sort of being a beacon of light as they get better and improve. And that goes on. And I think it's the same thing here where you've seen someone whose life was in some ways the darkest you could think about in terms of the kind of things that he was supporting and preaching. And now it's completely turned around. So instead of being a tornado of chaos, it's really a beacon of light.
Well, now I want to go to this other topic. So did you ask your mom if you could go with her? Or how did that even come about?
Yeah, I'm sure. I don't know exactly. It was a while ago. But
you were
I'm
aware
sure.
that she had a problem.
She had gone to rehab and, you know, out of state. And so after she came back, probably because I wanted to spend time with her. I don't know exactly why. But yeah, I sometimes would go with her to these meetings.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sure that had a profound impact on you, even more than you.
It had a tremendous impact on me because you saw people in a world that's totally different than your normal world at 7, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not the usual. Mm-hmm. And people who were homeless. I remember one time I was walking to prayers on Saturday morning with Elio Yardeni, and someone very clearly homeless goes by on the bike and stops and starts talking to me. And Elio says, how do you know this guy? I said, oh, because I knew him from before, from this room. So I got to meet people who were in very difficult situations. And not only that, but my mother was very active in supporting people and being a sponsor for these people and other things. So that rubbed off on me tremendously. And there were things, I mean, I remember once one guy he had been I forget, hurt somehow, and he didn't have any money. So they asked, where do you, can you drop him off? He was homeless, so he dropped him off at my place. So I, it was first they come home, and I saw him. He's there on the front porch, covered in blood on the one side of him. And so I go in, I cut off the sock, and, you know, that's caked in blood and things like that, you know, try to be helpful. Yeah. So it was very interesting experiences.
You were not seven then, were you?
Probably eight or something.
Gosh.
Yeah, something like that. Maybe nine. I can't remember exactly. Definitely not 10 yet. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Definitely eight or maybe eight. Yeah.
Wow. You weren't traumatized by any of this?
Well, you know me well enough. Yeah. Judge for yourself.
Super inspired.
But, and just seeing so many people who had been in positions that were almost hopeless, right? I mean, some of these people were in positions that they were either in prison or people who had been separated from their children taken from them, all sorts of things. And they didn't lose hope. They didn't lose the will to keep moving forward. And eventually, I'm sure there was a process. It's not like it's a linear thing right up and to the right. But the fact that those people could do that made me feel that nobody is past the point of redemption.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. We never kind of are able to piece together what makes us who we are, but also makes us make the right decision at the time when the time comes. And I think what you're expressing, your childhood and all of these opportunities you had, really, even, you know, most people would probably be scared or not want to be, to really see what you saw, led you to be really not just the person you are, but in that moment, in when you found yourself in the situation, like, it was clear to you what was right to do.
Yeah, I felt strongly that, and of course, sometimes we think that we know what's right to do, and we're completely wrong. A lot of people who are very confident are also creating some of the biggest chaos in the world. So I think it's important to be humble and ask really honestly whether or not my idea is coming from the right place, whether it's helping or hurting people, whether it's promoting human dignity or opposing human dignity, whether it's making me see more of the spark of the creator within the other person or not. Mm-hmm. And if it's doing those things, I feel like it'll probably work out pretty well. And if not, you know, I can't bet 1,000.
Right. But I think it's an important point, because in retrospect, probably your experiences with your mother and AA prepared you for this,
absolutely,
encounter with Derek.
Absolutely. It was a very, very, very much formative experience in my life.
Mm. Beautiful. Beautiful. Is there anything else you'd want to share with our listeners around this idea, which I think, again, our desire for our listeners to be inspired to, like Monica said, life is too short not to do the right thing.
I just think it's so easy for us to focus on what difference there may be between ourselves and the other person. And that becomes the driving force. And you can see it in extreme groups that they end up hating each other because they disagree over some tiny point. And it is shocking how people can agree about 99% of everything. Mm-hmm. And the 1% things that they disagree about is enough for us to hate and kill each other over.
Politics.
So maybe instead of focusing on that 1%, we can focus on that 99% and the spark of the creator that's the same in every one of us.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and I believe inspiring our listeners.
Thank you for having me.
Stay spiritually hungry.